All right, well, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. We're doing another remote interview today, and I'm really excited to have our author on for today's interview. Can't wait to get into this, Mark. Mark Thielman is a criminal magistrate working in Fort Worth, Texas. He spent 27 years as a prosecutor for Tarrant and Dallas counties. A two-time Black Orchid winner and Derringer finalist, Mark has authored more than 50 published short stories. And yes, you heard me right, 50 published short stories. His story, The Kratz Gambit, will be included in the upcoming The Best Private Eye Stories of the Year anthology. Mark serves as president of the North Dallas chapter of Sisters in Crime. In April 2025, Severn River published his debut novel, The Devil's Kitchen. The second book in the series, The Hidden River, will be published in October. So, Mark, congratulations and welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon.
Jeff, it's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Mark, 50 stories, that's a heck of an accomplishment. When did you first start writing?
I started writing in 2016. I worked for the district attorney's office for a number of years, first in Dallas, and then I moved over to Fort Worth. Then we had an election with a new DA, and she wanted to take the office in one direction, and she didn't want to take either my wife or I with her. So my wife, being the smarter and the braver of the two of us, she said, you know, I've listened to you talk about being a writer for years. Stay home, take some time, pursue this dream. I'll go find a job. So she did. You know, she kept us fed. I wrote my stories. And shortly after that, the first one was picked up. It was one of the Black Orchid novella winners that you mentioned in the introduction. That gets published in Alfred Hitchcock, and it's been a great ride ever since.
So how many years did it take to publish 50 stories? Because, I mean, that really is an impressive number.
Well, you know, you write a lot of different things. I don't like to be pigeonholed. I didn't want to be just a short story writer. I kept working on novels. Now that I've got a successful novel out, I still keep trying to write my stories. So I have been working on them continuously from 2016 to the present. That's, you know, I mean, obviously, these days with the novel pressure, I don't produce as many, but I still like to try to get 5 or so stories out a year. That's part of my community too, and they're a lot of fun to write. They're nice palate cleansers when you've finished a novel and you just don't want to start something that long right away. Knock yourself out a 5,000-word short story. It's a great vacation.
You know, I do that between novels, too, if I'm not in a series or, you know, where I have a lot of deadline pressure. What about, like, writing a short story? Because it's such a short window, right? They're short, they're quick to write, and then you tend to land them quicker, they tend to get published quicker. Do you feel like that instant gratification or near-instant gratification is keeps you more energized than, say, novel writing?
I like to be able to sit down, you know, and knock it out, and if you're putting out 1,000 words a day, you can get the rough draft done in a week, and then you've got this product that you then obviously go back and revise and tinker with. Now, I'm sure like you, I've got some stories that I knock out in a week, and some that I've worked on and off with for they've been there in the drawer for a year or so, and they're just not quite ready to go. But the magazines come out, and you get to see your name in print, and you get that little endorphin rush that I get anytime I publish something.
You know, I always, people like when you go to conferences and things, so a lot of times I feel like short story writers don't get the same credit. You know, it's always very focused on novels, but when you write, and I've published a bunch of short stories, I mean, it's hard. Like, it's hard in a different way. You know, it is shorter. You don't have to have all these multiple plots. It doesn't take you, anywhere near as long to complete. But every word counts. You know, when you're talking about, like, a 5,000-word, maximum, that's really hard to get people to care about characters and be able to give enough about them and backstory and everything.
You know, you're right. Barb Goffman, Art Taylor, early on taught me one lesson that, you know, a short story is about one thing. And as long, you know, you have to determine what that one thing is right off the bat and don't lose your focus. It's real easy particularly, you know, if you've got this novel background to kind of develop this subplot and that subplot. And, you know, you need to kind of mix things up a little bit, but you got to stay focused on that one thing. And once, if you don't, suddenly you've got this, you know, this big pile of gibberish that nobody would publish. So, you know, you got to stay, return to that principle.
Do you think that short story writers and novel writers, like, their mind works differently, not all the time, but when they're in the work? Like, when I write some short stories, but I'm mostly a novelist. And when I'm writing, I'm doing exactly what you're talking about, right? I'm thinking of backstory and subplots and, like, in the depth, but you can't do that in a short story. And some of the short story writers I know, when they move to novels, also have difficulty with that. They're like, okay, I finished my novel. I'm at 38,000 words, you know? So, I mean, do you feel like the approach to story internally is somehow different?
Personally, I don't. I mean, you know, at the end, they are both, I think, both work when they're good storytelling. And now, you know, the medium that you're using puts certain guardrails, side rails on what you're trying to do. So, you know, I have to restrict myself to that one thing when I'm working on a short story. But, again, yeah, I think of it as just, how can I tell this story? And I'm sure, like yourself, you know, sometimes I've started out thinking I'm going to write a short story, and I say, no, this idea really is going to be a novel. And I've got a couple of, short stories that I thought were going to be novels, but once I started, it was, you know, it really takes about 5,000 words to tell this tale. So you should just put the end and, you know, not try to put another 75,000 words of air into this, because, you know, that's not going to work.
That's great advice. Have you ever taken a published short story and turned the characters in it or the world into a novel?
I haven't. I've got, you know, a couple of things where I've entertained the idea of trying to, you know, tell a novel in stories. But, you know, particularly since this book has taken off, it's one of those projects that's on the shelf. I've got a couple I'd like to come back to. Let me take that back. The first short story I wrote, the first Black Orchid winner, had as a sleuth the Restoration poet John Milton, and I wrote a short story that Alfred Hitchcock liked, and I subsequently wrote a novel. It's sitting in a drawer somewhere, waiting for people to, you know, appreciate it, you know, for the work of art that it is. But yes. So the first one, I actually did write a book using the characters from the first novel, from the first short story.
That's really interesting. I always it's so easy to get attached to characters, you know, especially when you get good feedback on them. I hate parting from characters. Do you ever feel like that?
Well, you know, I mean, that one, of course, because, I mean, it was the first short story. It was the first one that got published. My world was those characters. And so, you know, I didn't want to let them go. So I wrote the book. I'm this book that has come out, The Devil's Kitchen. You know, I've got a multi-book contract for this one, so I've written, you know, these characters for a while now, and yeah, they're part of my family. I talk to them like I do, you know, my wife, the kids, and the dogs.
You know, non-writers, when they hear that, they think you're crazy, but these characters really do live in your head, don't they?
Oh, it's you know, the yes, absolutely. And it sounds funny, Jeff, when you do it, because of course there's a little French component in this first book. So when I'm talking about it, of course I fall into this accent that sounds like I'm, you know, I've just watched too many Pepe Le Pew episodes, and it's horrible. But yeah, that's kind of how we talk to one another.
You know, I dictate a lot, and sometimes I'll be walking down the street, and when I'm doing a dialogue, I'll do that too, unconsciously. I'll just fall into the dialects or whatever that I'm talking, and people do look at me funny.
Yeah, yeah. Like you should be wearing a tinfoil hat, right? You're kind of one of those scary people that won't you keep your room. We're the same thing. You know, all my books are set in national parks, so my wife and I are doing some research at Yosemite, and you're kind of walking around and saying, this would be a good place to kill somebody, and everybody moves away from you. You know, suddenly you're in a crowded park. You got elbow room because nobody wants to stand that close to you.
Can't blame them. So why don't you tell us about your debut? What is it about?
Well, thank you. Clarence Johnson is a medically retired homicide detective. He's a former cop. He's a former football player. He's a former fiancé. While he's trying to figure out what he is now, he takes a job as a seasonal ranger at Yellowstone National Park. While he's there, a body is found at the base of Yellowstone Falls. Allison Nance is an investigator with the National Park Service's Investigative Services Branch. And she needs Clarence's expertise, and he needs a purpose. So she enlists him to assist in this investigation. And as they begin to dig into it, they discover that the answers may lie with a secret that has been buried since the time of the French Revolution. So it's a little history. It's a little art. It's a little thriller. And then it's a little bit of a good police procedural. So I hope it's a little bit of, a little something for any reader.
Oh, it sounds great. And I mean, it's interesting because you are hitting on a bunch of different genres, right? Well, is it primarily, would you say, crime? Or what is the primary category?
It's a murder investigation. The publisher calls it a dual timeline thriller. So that's what I use when I describe it. But it's a murder investigation where some of the questions run deeper than the present day.
So how much do you think it's like an anachronism to try to put these labels to, like for various subgenres? And you're calling it a thriller, so it's fast paced, so that makes sense, and it's crime inciting, and there's stakes and everything. But like so much of that, right, came out of like the traditional model, going to bookstores, and now 70-80% of all books are sold online on Amazon, right? So do you think it really matters anymore whether you're like primarily in one genre?
I don't think I don't know that it does. I mean, certainly, I was fortunate that a publisher, although they had trouble defining what it was, they read it, they liked it, and they've been very gracious about publishing it. But yeah, I mean, when you look at even the New York Times bestseller list, I mean, there's these, what they call them romanticies, right? I mean, there are romantic fantasies. There, the portmanteaus are coming out everywhere to try to describe the books that are being published today. And people love them, people buy them, people read them, people seem to enjoy them. But they'd be hard to classify if you were trying to arrange the books on a shelf in a, in a traditional bookstore.
Yeah, for a long time, everybody was publishers were trying to stay away from like mixed genre books. Mm-hmm. Yet, it's like this artificial environment, right? Where like agents and publishers they see certain things all the time, and they're into the industry, but readers don't see any of that. Like you just described a really interesting book, and I know exactly like what I'm getting based on how you described it, what the back jacket copy is. You look at it, it's a great cover. Severn River Publishing did a great cover. And so I know what I'm getting, and that's kind of what matters, right? It's just sort of the reader experience.
At the end of the day, we wouldn't be writers if we didn't have somebody out there who wanted to read it, right? So it's, hopefully we're giving them, a fulfilling experience. Now, we've all had the mistake or the unfortunate to pick up a book that you thought was one thing and, turned out to be something completely different. And I think, we get those problems, like you said, when a publisher or someone tries to say, it's like this but different, is kind of the traditional model for selling a book to a publisher. And so if they can be honest, tell what it's about, use that back jacket copy, and then let the search engines help guide readers to it, I think we end up probably in a better place.
I think you're absolutely right. It's that expectations, if they're thwarted when they read the book, maybe they even really like it, but if it's not what they expected, I think you can be disappointed. I had somebody pick up one of my thrillers and they left a good review, but they said, but this is definitely not a mystery. And I was wondering where they got the mystery thing from, because I'd never described it as that.
The first review I got was, said, I, it was a fine book, but I don't care for, all of this historical stuff. Well, sorry, when you describe it as a dual timeline thriller, I don't know quite what you expect, but it's, I think we were honest in what we said about it, and they just missed when they picked it up, I guess. So, sorry.
I'm curious about that dual timeline, because I've written that in a couple of books, and I really enjoy it. When you're writing those, do you write one timeline through, or are you going back and forth as you're creating?
It's a tennis match for me. I write this chapter and I write that chapter, and then I go back to the other timeline. I thought about trying to stick with one all the way through, and this one works for me. And of course, do I like the old one or the new one better? I usually like whichever one I'm not working on right now better, because it's not giving me Pepe Le Pew's not fighting with me when I'm when I'm working in the contemporary one. So,
what is it, the time frame for the historical timeline?
For the Devil's Kitchen, it surrounds the French Revolution, and it brings. All of this is revealed fairly early. There is the Scepter of Dagobert is the oldest of the French crown jewels. It was, by legend, crafted by Saint Eligius, the patron saint of goldsmiths, and was made for the French kings. It disappeared during the French Revolution and has never been found. So when I discovered this tidbit, that naturally you can't help but ask, well, where might it be? And that led me to ask, what would be the most obscure part of the French Empire at the time? And what we now call Wyoming could very easily have been a place. If you wanted to hide something as far away as possible, that's where it would have been, you might have put it. So it starts at the French Revolution and kind of works its way forward.
Did you have an expertise in that time period, or was this just something you learned as you researched the novel?
I researched. It was research, like lots of our readers, I try to read widely, the French Revolution is just it's a fascinating time to read about. You can't help but kind of get immersed in it, and then you start going down these different rabbit holes and suddenly find yourself with the material for a story.
Do you do all the research in advance, or is it something you do as you write?
I don't know that it's possible to do all the research in advance. I don't know what you found, but I try to do a whole lot of research on the park that I'm talking about. I'm going to be talking about on the time period, but then of course. Even when I was trying a case, sometimes, you're going along and you say, oh, I should have asked that. I need to know the answer to that question before I go any further. And so, there'll be a pause. And then whether it's a trip to a local library or a Google search or whatever it is to try to find what sort of shoes did they wear? Could you go tromping through the mud in those kinds of shoes? Or would they be falling off? Do I need to make them barefoot, three quarters of the way through? I don't know. I didn't think to look about that beforehand. So then I take a pause.
That's the challenge of historicals, right? I was writing one with a 46 BC timeline, and I read like 27, 28 books before I even started, right? I did a lot of research. Yeah. And then I got to the first scene, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Did they even have beds, or what were they made out of?
Right.
It's every scene, right? It's so hard. But once you do the research and you're into it, though, you know so much about this time period. Are you tempted to write more in that time period?
Well, fortunately, I guess. Do I get different ideas? Absolutely. Fortunately, I guess to wean me off that, if you're writing a series, one of the decisions that I needed to make early on was, did I want to continue with all of my park investigations in Yellowstone, or did I want to go to the different parks? Now, the ISB, the Investigative Services Branch of the National Park Service, that's the Park Service FBI. And there are 34 agents, I think, when they're all staffed to cover the 63 national parks. And so it really lends itself for them to go to different locations and to see different things. And, you know, and when they go to different spots, you see it, I think they somewhat see it through newcomers' eyes. So it allows me, when I go, to look around and, you know, and to see it perhaps as an investigator just arriving on the scene, right? And so I don't go back. I keep, you know, go to a different park, and that doesn't always lend itself to the same historical time period.
But does that keep your, like, spark your creative energy moving to new areas?
Oh, it's, you know, it's fun and it's fascinating, and it's always fun to start the projects. You know, there's always a middle in there somewhere where, you know, you, again, I'm using my Pepe Le Pew voice and I'm getting angry at everybody. But to begin with, it's always exciting, right? It's a first day of school.
So you mentioned, like, it is, right? You when you first start, everyone has that energy. They're getting into it. But somewhere between 30 and 40,000 words, most writers kind of hit that muddy middle. They hit that wall. They start looking at their manuscript going, where am I going? And this is terrible. And, like, so many people drop out during that period. When you're moving from, you know, short story into novel, did you have that moment in the middle when you were having trouble moving forward?
You're going to let me open up my can of aphorisms now. You know, one of those things that you hear when you talk to writers that I wish I could give it proper credit is, you know, you can fix bad words, but you can't fix no words. And when I'm writing a short story, or whether I'm writing this novel, I mean, you know, soldier on, just, you know, keep putting the words down. They may be lousy, but you can fix them if you got them there. If you just kind of stop and say, this isn't working, you know, now, inertia, you keep moving, or once it comes, you know, a body at rest tends to stay at rest, right? So, no, I try to keep going no matter what difficulties get in my path.
I mean, that's really great advice. I give that to many young writers all the time. So, as an author, I'm sure the question you get the most from people, from readers, is like, where do you get your ideas, or how did you get this? But I'm always curious, like, was it the spark that led to, like, a novel? Was it the learning about that missing jewel? Was that the thing that got you interested in this, or was it something else?
Here's my next aphorism. You know, I think my novels begin where serendipity meets opportunity. True story. I was on my computer. One of the nice things about being a writer is that you can, you know, when you find some interesting website, you can go ahead and click on it and call it research. And the website I discovered was 10 Hidden Treasures Waiting to Be Found. And sure enough, the Scepter of Dagobert was there. And I was like, well, that's really cool. And then, you know, that leads to the question, where might it be? And, I mean, my family, we've always loved the national parks. And so it was, well, could it really be in Yellowstone? And, you know, well, that was French territory. Yes, it could. And so off we went. So the Hidden Scepter of Dagobert was the spark that got me started.
Yeah, I love that. So how much is, like, you have this love of, you know, hiking and parks. How important is it for writers when they're writing these books to bring in some of their interests where they already have some base level of knowledge, but more importantly, they also have some level of enthusiasm?
Well, getting back to your earlier question, you know, I think, you know, you're going to hit a part where it's a slog. And, you know, I mean, if you're writing something that you're truly excited about, that's going to help sustain you. I mean, I have, you know, in the quest to become a published novelist, I've written some books that somebody had said, you know, this, and this are three elements that all the best-selling books have now. And so, you know, I mean, it was a writing assignment. You sat down, you do the job. But it wasn't my passion, and consequently, those books have never sold because, you know, I think that comes through your writing. You know, if you really care, even if it's not specifically described, you know, I mean, if you care about the hills, the trees, the rocks, if you love Yellowstone, if you love history, I mean, if you kind of get excited about those things, I think you put that's reflected in the prose.
So, you know, you mentioned like these unpublished manuscripts. That's so common, right, with authors, and it's so difficult. Like the numbers, when I have a new writer, I'm always hesitant to tell them how unlikely it is that they'll get published, you know, because you don't want to scare them away because you want them to write the thing. But there's also this reality. Readers think you write a book and it's out there and everyone's celebrating it and you're doing book tours. And in fact, it's like 1 out of 4,000 queries gets picked up by an agent, you know, and they probably sell less than half of what they represent to like to publishers. Like it's really not a good percentage. So, you know, when you finally get there and you get this debut book out and it's with a good publisher, and full disclosure, it's my publisher too. They're wonderful. But when you get this out there, I'm curious like what that experience was like for you, because I know people who are like waiting to have that are just, you know, they love to hear these stories, and we've all kind of gone through a different thing. So tell us about that moment. I mean, did you have an agent or did you query publishers directly?
I had an agent. She had seen, again, the novel, getting back to the Milton novel, the unpublished historical novel that I wrote about John Milton. I mean, she kindly looked at it and liked it and thought it could be a commercial property. As you said, even though an agent took it, didn't mean it was going to sell. And I mean, she's handled any number of books because she believed they could be sold, and maybe someday they will. But this was the first one. And, you know, when she called and said, this publisher wants to talk to you, can you, you know, could you make some free time for him? And it was, Paula, this is going to sound desperate. I'm available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You dress that up. You tell them, you know, as a criminal magistrate, I'm kind of a judge, and because I control the courtroom, I can rearrange my schedule to accommodate. The truth was, 2 a.m. on a Tuesday, I was going to be there, right? Because this was, it was a dream. And hopefully what the lesson that those unpublished folks that you talk to see in folks like us is that, you know, okay, it may take a while. You know, the first one came out a decade after I started writing them, but, you know, dreams can happen.
But that's normal, right? It's really normal for it to take some time to get a book published. You hear about these, you know, debut sensations that hit the bestseller list, and it's like getting hit by lightning, like literally, right?
Sure.
So, you know, and even some of the best-selling authors that we all know their names often didn't break out to like 10, 12 books in. Mm-hmm. You know, they had a lot of books that really didn't do too much. So who was your first call after you got the call from your agent saying you had interest from a publisher?
Well, I didn't have to call my wife. I think she heard the high-pitched scream that sounded, you know, kind of like a 7-year-old. And then, you know, she had to come in to see whether I'd cut myself. And then my family. It sort of broadened out from there. Ripples on a pond.
So I'm not going to ask specifics on this, but just in general, and I know that your publisher is very reputable and their contracts are good. When you get a contract and your agent's looking at it, Was there an impulse to like push back on certain things or renegotiate or talk when it's been so long, right? Authors go through this all the time. Sometimes with less reputable publishers, they'll sign a contract that's terrible, right? Just because they're so happy to be published again. Did you do any negotiation on your contract without specifics?
Yes. I mean, you know, you as a debut novelist or as a potentially debut novelist. I mean, I was never dishonest with myself about where the power in this relationship lies, right? I mean, this is not a level playing field. I mean, there are more people begging them than I'm. And so yeah, you know, your first question is, okay, what can I ask about that won't screw this up? But that being said, there has to be agency. I mean, you're responsible for your own future. I mean, you've got an agent to help you. Your publisher wants you to succeed. But at the end of the day, you're your own agent. And so, yeah, there was some vague language, particularly relating to perhaps secondary rights and other things, that it was just, okay, I don't understand this. And, you know, I mean, people assume that that lawyers know everything about all matters of law. I was clueless, and so I just said, you know, I don't understand this. And then, you know, and we tinkered with it until they were happy and I was happy. And it was the margins.
Yeah, I think that's important for people to know that they can have an honest conversation, you know, and just a polite, honest conversation and see if something works. People can always say they don't want to change it, right?
Right.
So when you finally do the contract, you go through the editing process, was it three levels of editing or you had a copy editor? How did that work?
We had we had two levels. There was a, you know, copy editor who then sent it back, and then there was the line editor, line editing. We didn't have any for the other books, the ones that have been working on since. Severin has some developmental editing that they use, you know this, and so I've taken advantage of that preliminary step just to kind of say, why don't you? What are your thoughts? What can we do to help make this a better story for everyone? Because, you know, you get real close to it, and sometimes things that you think are obvious aren't to a neutral party. So I've started using that third developmental level early on in my writing, but for the first book it was copy and line.
That's so smart. You know, it's really perceptive. You do get too close to things, and it's hard to step back. And as writers, right, you write that thing that's in your head, but it doesn't necessarily convey to the page like you think it does, you know? So the book, you get the contract signed, you go through the process, you end up getting author copies, right? So when that box of books shows up, tell us about that day. And I love to hear these stories too, because this whole writing business is just filled with rejection and heartache, and it's so difficult, but these are the success stories.
Yeah. I will take it back. I mean, I think to illustrate, you know, I mean, so you're working on it, and then they send you, here's the mock-up of the cover. And, you know, what do you think of this as, you know, as cover art? And, you know, and you get that email and you open it up and it's like, folks, all I'm seeing is my name at the bottom. The rest of it, sure. I mean, I've redlined on joy right there. And so and as it happens, they did produce a cover that I was just thrilled to be associated with. But yeah, then the book arrives and, you know, I mean, then you've got it there in your hands. And again, the first place I go is to the bottom of the page. And it's the fulfillment of a dream. I think for lots of us. I mean, I've had, had enjoyed my career in law, had a great time, felt like I've done some good, but this is something that I'm as excited about as any case I've been involved with.
Yeah, that is, it's really a special moment. And they do great covers. I think I speak to a lot of authors, you know, self-published authors, unpublished authors. And one of the things I notice is sometimes authors have ideas for covers, but it's an art, right?
Yeah.
It's a selling document. That cover's there for a reason, you know, and there's so much science and art behind it that when they ask me what I think, it's usually like, it's beautiful. Do whatever you think is best. You know, like, yeah, I think it's important as authors that you recognize your limitations. If you haven't studied this and the marketing and the behavioral economics of it, it's probably best to stay out of it.
I try to make one comment just so that they, you know, just so that they know I was really paying attention. I mean, they have no idea how much attention I was paying. I mean, you know, but I want to make one say, you know, how about this? Just that's my way to signal I really indeed have looked at it and, you know, and I really like what you're doing. Because in fact, we're looking at the cover for the third book right now and I really like what they're doing. So.
So I want to talk to you just a little bit about craft in this. When you're developing characters, first off, are you a plotter or pantser? Do you outline the whole book before you begin?
I'm a plotter generally I'm a plotter. Sometimes there's always, I want to leave a little room for the muse in there at some point. So I'm a plotter with an asterisk. I don't think we have plotters, we have pantsers, and then some people try to call them plancers. I mean, I think I try to stay more to my outline, but you know, sometimes you're going along and if you're talking to all these characters, sometimes they say, you need to rethink this. That's, you know, I wouldn't do that. Or, you know, or I'd bring some help. And then suddenly you have to, you know, write some characters that you didn't have originally. And so, anyway, long answer to your question. Yeah, I'm a plotter.
No, it's that's good stuff. I mean, honestly, this is the stuff I think writers need to talk about, right? So, like, when you, maybe not in this manuscript because you've written several, but in earlier manuscripts, when you had characters making choices or doing things that you hadn't planned for them to do as you get to know them better, did you always go with what you thought the character should be doing, or did you ever, like, reject it and stick to your outline?
I would, you know, I mean, yes, I think, you know, those are the points where you need to say, again, we're really not as detached from reality as, you know, I mean, as we may sound as we're having this conversation. I mean, I know that, you know, these characters are created in my head, and so I need to step back and say, okay, when I, in a cold light of day, I wrote down this outline because I thought this was the best way forward. And now the characters are suggesting this. Is it really something I'm doing? Is it a cheap out because that's an easy thing to write? You know, or was the outline wrong? And so I think you can have a, you know, it's now a three-way conversation. The outline jumps in and says, you know, believe me. And this one says, no, believe me. And, you know, and then you have to arbitrate between the two of them. And sometimes the answer is we're going to strike a middle path where we're not quite going this direction. We're not quite going that direction.
The magistrate in you is coming through now.
Well, you know, we're going to listen to both sides and make a decision, right?
I love it. So when you're developing these characters, do you plan out, like, character arc, like, you know, the wants and needs and the change that's going to occur in the characters, or do you let the plot kind of drive that as you go?
I didn't to begin with. You know, as we go along, and I've never done, you know, I go to the sometimes to these author conferences, and they talk about knowing what flavor of ice cream, you know, your character likes, and I've never kind of drilled down to that level. I've looked at some of these, you know, there's some questionnaires that are available online, and I've tried to answer them. Pardon me, sometimes I get frustrated that, I mean, with the questions, and I let it go and move on. For the book I'm working on now, I've probably done as much thinking about it, on the historical arc, just to kind of help bring those characters, round them out a little bit. I've done more off the book's backstory than I've ever done before.
So this is a series, and this was book one. You've got book two coming out soon. How do you handle character change for your main characters when you know there's a, I assume it's an unending series, like you don't know, it's not a trilogy or you don't know how long it'll go, is that right?
We're committed to four, and, you know, of course, I argue, listen, there are 63 national parks, let's just go ahead and, you know, and sign the 63 book deal right now. They say, let's wait a minute, you know, we'll get back to you on that, right? That's one of my helpful suggestions that's been pushed aside for now. So I don't know how long it's going to go. We'll ride for as long as we can, right?
Well, it's a really cool concept where you can, because you keep the theme up and it's, you know, the investigations in national parks. Yeah, everyone is, you know, there's a huge difference between a national park in Maine or, you know, Big Bend, right? Like, they're so different. So you can really have difference in your books, but keep them branded together. I love that.
Thank you.
How do you do the change in the characters as you go? Like, how do you, like, you know, like, you can, in a standalone book, you can have enormous change, right? Flaws and frailties or misbeliefs that change by the end of the book. But you can't have these huge changes book after book after book with, like, your protagonist. Mm-hmm. So how do you handle that? And I'm asking, so I'm writing a series, and I'm really looking for an answer here.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a two-part, and you can you take which part works for you. Now, as I mentioned while I was talking about the book, I've got Clarence Johnson was a homicide detective from Fort Worth who had to leave the force, and he's looking for a purpose. So he is a city cop who now finds himself in, you know, in a wilderness environment. And you know, he knows a lot about criminal investigation, but he doesn't know much about how things work in the Rocky Mountains. Allison Nance came off a ranch in Montana, and she... it's become a police officer, but as a Yellowstone National Park just doesn't have that many murders. So she knows a lot about how to survive in the wild, and, you know, and the mountains and rivers and trees, and has a real love affair with the environment, but doesn't know as much about the details of a homicide investigation. So there's a natural arc where they're both learning a little bit about the other. So that allows for growth. Then the second book, The Hidden River, is set in the Everglades. One of the reasons I set it there was it takes Allison completely out of the mountains and puts her on the flattest place, arguably, in the world. I mean, there's a 14 feet of elevation loss in the 150 miles from Lake Okeechobee to the Gulf of Florida. I mean, you know, it's flat. And so, you know, suddenly all of her world is upended. And it allows, I think, you know, for character development and character growth. Plus, you have these two people who were thrown together in book one who are now, you know, getting to know each other a little better. And so you have these opportunities for character development there. So a series allows, I think, change environment, change in personality taking place over time.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned, like, the murders and think about this national investigative agency working in these parks, but without maybe the experience that you get as a homicide detective in Baltimore, you know, where you're seeing these all the time. What was the most surprising thing you learned during, like, your research about this investigative agency?
Well, you know, when I started, digging in, I didn't know that the National Park Service, you know, we all see the Park Service Rangers with the flat hat Stetsons and those folks. I didn't know that there was an ISB to begin with. And then, you know, as we talk about serendipitous moments, it was to discover that, you know, that they have their own investigative branch was like, oh, you know, lucky day for you, Mark. Here's a, you know, this works for really well. You know, and when you think of the nice thing, we'll speak craft for a moment. You know, as a writer, if you're writing something contemporary, the biggest problems, you know, one of the big problems you have to address is, well, why didn't they just pull out their cell phones and call for help? Why didn't they just take the DNA swab and do all of that? When you set your books in a wilderness environment, you don't have cell phone towers. You don't have ring cameras on every door. Your crime scene degrades pretty quickly. I mean, there's a lot of things that they can learn, they can see, and they can take. But a lot of the CSI stuff that, as writers, you have to kind of write around if you want to do a traditional procedural, those problems don't exist in the wilderness for a guy like me.
No, I love books set like yours in these austere environments where things are harder. I wonder though, like, you know, the CSI effect. I'm sure you've seen it as a magistrate, but the CSI effect for like readers, because I mean, we have all this technology now, but a lot of people still get murdered every year, and most of those murders go unsolved. You know, so like while the technology's there, do you find like with readers you have to try to explain things in a way so they understand that there isn't DNA that's immediately matched with everybody at every scene and everything isn't recorded on some kind of satellite imagery?
Because I think since when I set them in wilderness environments, I can usually just sort of, you know, remind the readers. And I think most people say, yeah, you know, I've walked in the woods. I've never seen a ring camera on a pine tree. If I did, it's probably because somebody nefarious put it there, right? So it kind of cuts the other way. The CSI effect, I mean, even back to the prosecutor days, I mean, that was one of the things that when you were talking to juries, you know, you had to make sure they understood, you know, Star Trek was about space travel. We really have space travel, but could everybody agree that it's really not like that? I mean, we don't have phasers and transporters. Okay, now let's talk. We really do have the ability to extract DNA, but we can't do it like they do in CSI. Great TV, not real crimes.
Oh, that's a great analogy. I love it.
Well, I've used it in front of the citizens of Tarrant County a time or two, so you're welcome to it.
Yeah, that's really smart. I want to talk to you a little bit about your the writing community. You're the president of Sisters in Crime, is that correct?
Local chapter.
Well, let me start at the beginning, because I mean, community is so important, and this writing is such an isolated, you know, a pursuit. Do you use beta readers for your work?
I do. Yes, it's. I mean, my wife is always my first beta reader, and then you know, but then you have to expand your circle because I mean, you know, she understands that she needs to not be afraid to tell me, you know, if a section clunks, that she has to be able to do that. But it's always easier to get it out there, and I try to tailor my beta readers a little bit to the book I'm working on. I mean, I reached out. I've just turned in the book 3 in this series, and there's a little bit of a musical angle. So, kind of, you know, some of my people who might be know a little bit about pictorial art that I talked to for book 1 might not, you know whether I got my terms wrong for book 3. So I vary my audience, my beta readers a little bit depending upon the specifics of my subject. But yeah, you need to have somebody who's removed take a look at it and just say, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah, that's good advice. Do you give them, beyond the thumbs up, thumbs down, do you give them like specific questions or like a sheet or some guidance in what kind of feedback you're looking for?
Usually what I say is, you know, take the book, read the book, then, you know, let me buy you lunch and we'll talk about it. And then, you know, so when we sit down over lunch, I have some questions, but I don't want them reading too. I found that if I gave them questions beforehand, they read to those questions and, you know, and maybe, you know, I want their unbiased appraisal of the whole book. And so you tell me that first and then let's talk about, you know, these specific things.
Do you pick, beyond going, like, beyond your immediate family, do you pick beta readers who read that specific genre?
I would like to have most of the people that I've reached out to, I mean, I think are usually broad-based readers. I mean, everybody should, anytime I ask, I want people who've read some, because we have tropes, right? We have some things that I think as a reader you expect to see in a book, and you're going to be disappointed if it's not there. And so I want my beta readers to feel like they understand the genre, but you know, been broadly enough that when a book talks about national parks and art and, you know, and murder and antiquity, or at least, you know, French history, they can kind of feel the sort of people who might buy this book.
Did you have a subject matter expert within the investigative service or somebody who could kind of give you some inside information about what the day-to-day is like?
I do. I originally, when I started this book, I wrote to the Yellowstone public information officer, and I said, do you have a retiree community? You know, somebody who, you know, just a group of folks that, and I tried Facebook to see if I could find one. I wasn't successful. So then I wrote to the ISB, the Investigative Services Branch, and I asked the same question to them. And I got an email back a little while later from a gentleman who's retired out of the Investigative Services Branch. And he and I started talking, and he's read all my books, and he weighs in and says, you know, that they're actually going south, not north, and it helps me get the details right with the investigation, and then it gives me input. And sometimes you say yes, and sometimes you say, I appreciate it, but you know, this is the story that needs to be told. So anyway.
So yeah, you're right. Sometimes those things are too realistic, they wouldn't be entertaining, right?
Right.
If so, you know, you have beta readers, you have subject matter experts. Do you also, are you part of a critique group, or have you ever been part of a critique group where people are looking at craft?
I've never used a critique group. I've thought about it a couple of times. It's, I guess, coming out of, I mean, again, I've come out of a short story tradition. I mean, you know, that was my community to begin with, and I'm sure they, you know, they would read the novels, but it's, I mean, it's the time commitment to read a novel is different than it is with a short story. And so we can, you know, we can trade short stories, but if they're not working on a book, it's not really fair, I don't think, to ask them to pore over it if they're never going to ask me to reciprocate. So I don't have a novel community yet.
And you mentioned we talk about Sisters in Crime. Like what is the benefit? And you, as president of your local chapter there, right? Why should people be joining organizations like this? What benefits do they get from it?
You know, and maybe you can tell me your experience. One of the things I have found is because most of us fail most of the time, the writing community is, I think, you know, the single most supportive group of folks I've been involved with. And again, well, I'm going to stay with short stories to begin with. If there's an anthology call and you submit a story and I submit a story and three or four others, I mean, you never ever get the feeling that I'm competing with Jeff for, you know, for this place. I mean, we're going to send them off and they're going to pick their 10, 12, 15, whatever stories there are. And there may be, you know, 500 of us submitting, but it's, you know, I never get the sense that I'm competing with you for it. So if you say, hey, could you take a look at this? I'm happy to do it. You're happy to do it. We're kind of, you know, we're yoke fellows pulling together. And one or the other of us may end up in the magazine or in the anthology, but it's not. You didn't take my spot. I've never thought that. So it's a, and anyway. So Sisters in Crime. What started was that my local chapter was doing an anthology, and you had to join to submit a story. So I did, and I've continued to stay. Because, yeah, some of my best friends in the writing community are part of that little chapter. And that's what keeps me there.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. You're absolutely right. And the writers who are in, like, mystery thriller suspense in that area tend to be really, really supportive. I mean, there's supportive writers in all genres, but especially in these groups. And the camaraderie is certainly wonderful.
You know, maybe we can dream of getting to a level where people are really jealous and backbiting, but you know, at the level that I'm swimming in, I have yet to see it. So, it doesn't happen. So.
I mean, I don't see it in these genres at all. You know, you go to like Thriller Fest, and you're having drinks with people who've got, you know, 50 million books in print, and all that they want to do is help you. Yeah. It's a really wonderful thing. So we're getting close to wrapping up here, but I have to ask you some process questions because I ask all writers, right? So, do you write every day?
Yes.
And do you write to a word count or page count, or do you give yourself an hour goal, or how do you keep yourself on task?
Well, yeah. let's break it down. I mean, the average book, you know, like The Devil's Kitchen, has roughly, you know, 80 to 100,000 words in it. So if you can make 1,000 words a day, that's, you know, you'll be done in about 3 months, right? So I would love to do 1,000 words a day. Some days, you know, it's magic and everything's working and that's easy. Other days, it's when I do sit down, I say, okay, you're not leaving here until you write 500. Knowing that someday it'll be the magic, and there'll be 15, and it'll all balance out. So I try to do 1,000 words a day. Some days.
Do you find is there an extra benefit to writing every day besides actually getting the words down, right? Like being the working and getting them on paper. Is there something about it living in your head every day that you find beneficial?
I think so. I don't know. Again, my particular method, I try to leave my last good idea for today unwritten, you know, just to leave that little bullet point on the page so that tomorrow I look at it and you're not staring at the blank page. And, you know, and at some point, you know, staring at a blank page becomes intimidating, right? I mean, what, Hemingway's White Bull or something is what he called it. You know, I've got that first idea there, so I can sit down and I can start writing, and maybe an hour from now, I'll go back and delete all of that, but at least there's a, you know, something there. And yeah, I mean, you know, if you do it every day, that white bull doesn't ever get a chance to grow up. I mean, it's just how you start
That's
every
great.
Day. It's like exercise. It's, my latest aphorism, if you muse, you lose, right? If you wait for that fully developed idea to come along, it's not going to get written. Writing is it's a craft. It's something you got to practice and do every day, I think. Or at least I do.
Are you one of these writers that can write anywhere, or do you have to be at your desk or in a certain place?
I like a dedicated space. I mean, I can't write. Now I'm going to walk that middle path. You made me declare plotter earlier, but this one, I can't write. I don't write on an airplane. I can sit and think about it and maybe, you know, jot notes and do some of that, but that's never worked for me. As we mentioned off camera, I'm up in Colorado doing some hiking, and I'm getting some of the greatest, most successful writing, most productive writing. Let's not say greatest. I haven't read it yet, but most productive writing, because, well, my clock says it's an hour later, so I wake up earlier. Nobody else is quite ready to drag out of bed, so I've got this free time in the morning when I can just go like mad, just me, the laptop, and a cup of coffee, and it's really working great.
Oh, that's magic when that comes together. So you're writing on a laptop. Do you use Scrivener, Word, or what kind of software? What do you actually write this thing in?
I just use Word.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, you mentioned you're hiking there, have you ever dictated when you're putting together a novel?
No, I haven't. I've never tried that. And, you know, again, I'm so clumsy. I really need to stay, you know, task focused when I'm walking on a trail or a, or I may become my own story one of these days.
When you're editing, are you using any kind of, like, there's a lot of AI editing software out there, Pro Writing Aid, AutoCrit, things like that, or are you basically just doing a spell check in Word?
I use Grammarly. I don't use it so much for all of their suggestions about how, but yeah, I mean, you know, as a spell check on steroids, you know, it finds all of those little things that you, even the, you know, you double spaced twice as opposed to single spaced. I mean, you know, it does a nice job of fixing all of those. Mm-hmm. And then what I've started doing, you know, with the last couple is use the Word function to have it, you know, read the book back to you. Mm-hmm. And that's, and then it reads the story to me. And sometimes, you know, just when you hear it, sometimes you say, that sounded a whole lot better in my head than it actually sounds when it's coming out of the speaker. So
it certainly works well with dialogue, right? Yeah. Hearing it out loud.
So Grammarly helps me with the, with the commas and the, some of the simple corrections. Then the audio helps me a lot.
Well, so I just have two final questions here. One that they ask everyone. You think you sort of answered it, but it's, where do you think story comes from? You mentioned the muse. You're saying these characters are coming out of your head, but it's such a magical thing, right? And characters start acting in ways you don't expect. Where do you think these magical stories come from that attract people to spend many hours reading your books?
Well, yeah, I think I will reiterate, I think the stories for me start where serendipity meets opportunity. I've got this vat of life experiences, I know you do, in various forms of criminal law. And so I like writing mystery. And so when I find this little nugget like the Scepter of Dagobert, I can take this thing that brought me joy, as well as these elements of the career that I've been happy to participate in for a long time, and meld them together. And I hope that when readers, if they engage with these stories, it's because they see this sincerity. I mean, you know, it's not, okay, I wasn't a park ranger. me know if you want to learn how to be a park ranger. There may be other books out there, but if you want, I have done the criminal law. I have been immersed in these other areas, and I hope that sincerity comes through.
Yeah, I think it does. Your writing's great. Has anything in this process, after all these years and getting this book out there and published, was there anything in the actual publishing, the launch, that surprised you?
I know we're trying to wrap up. I make a distinction. I don't know if you ever use this. I distinguish between writers and authors. I'm a writer when I'm sitting at my laptop, at 6 o'clock this morning with my cup of coffee, and I'm by myself and I'm talking to the voices and I'm doing all of that. I think author is that person who has the agency, who's responsible for promoting and selling and taking that book to the audience. And so what I've discovered is opportunities like this, opportunities to go to Thriller Fest, to be on a panel, to do a book signing where people come up and they engage and they talk to you. It's that public face of writing that's it's a tremendous amount of fun. I mean, I knew the writing was fun. I mean, I do that in the short stories, but there's not the promotion in a short story that there is in a novel. And so I've gotten the chance to do a lot more of that, and it's really been a good time.
Oh, yeah, you got to enjoy it because there's a lot of that, right? A lot of responsibility comes post publication. All right, so where should our readers go to find you?
Well, I've got my website. It's Mark Thielman. And, again, you can find us both through Severed River. You can find me on Amazon. And then my website, it has links to available on Audible as well as the e-reading and hardcovers or hard copies.
All right. Well, Mark, this has really been fun. You've left a lot of good nuggets for young writers here, too. I hope people really pay attention to what you've given us today. I hope, and I always ask readers and viewers, if they like your work, to please rate it on Amazon. Because that's where 70-80% of all books are sold, and it makes a really big difference. And the same thing with Elaine's Literary Salon. If people like it, please give us a rating. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Mark. This has been fantastic.
Jeff,
good luck.
Enjoy. Thank you.